He writes, the only way to find the answers to these questions was to follow the kids over time, and that is what I did. From 1982 until 1986, he spent a couple of hours a day, 3 days a week, hanging out with the kids in their homes, on the street, in clubs, and in crack houses. And the book, The Cocaine Kids, is the result. Terry Williams is a sociologist. He is currently a senior research scholar at the Center for Social Research at the City University of New York, working on a MacArthur Foundation-supported study of successful adolescent development in public housing neighborhoods. He is the co-author of another book entitled Growing Up Poor. As we talk with Terry Williams, we invite you to call in if you have questions or comments. Our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line so that no matter where you are, if you're outside of the immediate area here, and it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use our toll-free number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Williams, hello.
Hello. How are you doing, David?
Good. Thank you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for inviting me.
Maybe to start, you might set the scene for us and tell us about the neighborhood where these young people that you met and talked to live. What kind of a place is it?
Well, Washington Heights is a relatively old neighborhood. It's right above Harlem. It is not a poor neighborhood by any means. It has mixed ethnicities. There are old Jewish families, Irish, some Italians still live in Washington Heights. But it is increasingly a Dominican community since the 1950s. Over the last 30 years, Dominicans comprise probably the largest ethnic group and new arrivals in Washington Heights. Washington Heights has a great variety of not only ethnic groups but of activity, including, although I wrote about cocaine dealing, there are a great number of micro enterprises and a rather active economy in Washington Heights. Mm-hmm. A lot of entrepreneurs sort of make their way through Washington Heights with small stores and that sort of thing. But it's a very vibrant and very active community and a very good community.
The book, as I said, focuses on the lives of eight people that you got to know pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
All seven of them are Dominican.
Yeah.
One of these young guys is African American, and there is one woman in the group. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about the characters? Max was the person that you met first, and
yeah,
the person who introduced you to the rest, because they were members of his crew. They were the people that he put together to run the business. Tell me about Max.
Yeah. Well, first I should sort of tell you how that evolved.
Uh-huh.
I was introduced to Max by a friend of mine in the underground economy, a young man who I had interviewed for some other work I had been doing. And he knew Max through the cocaine scene pretty well, and I was beginning to write about it. After I met Max, Max had established what he called a setup, and a setup is where you put together other kids to form what was called at that time a crew. And a crew means a group that's organized to make money. You do this as a collectivity as opposed to the individual approach, which has heretofore been the method, because your ability to make more money and cover more markets, obviously, is increased.
Mm-hmm.
Max, I followed Max over several years, and in a way I sort of lucked out because I saw many kids come in and out of his crew. In other words, his setup where he would recruit, he would decide which kids happened to be trustworthy, which is the key in the cocaine market or the cocaine business. The key to making money is adulteration, and before you can get those drugs, you have to be trusted. It's based on consignment. And some of these kids did not work out for him in the setup, and he kept getting kids until he got this core group, which constitutes the cocaine kids.
And they were the most stable members of the crew over the time that you were talking with them and observing.
Yes, and it also is interesting too that it was also based on how they worked out. He would constantly test the kids. He would see rather. He would call up what they call call money. He would call them after giving them a consignment to see if they had the money. He would test to see if they were into freebasing. he would test to see if they were trustworthy on many levels, mm-hmm. and that determined who stayed in the crew and who was expelled.
Hmm. Max's brother is also one of the people that you talk about. His name is Hector.
Yeah.
And apparently, actually, Max took over the business from his brother when his brother, for a variety of reasons, he had a lot of personal problems. Maybe he was using too much of the drug himself. I think he also spent some time in jail. Did he?
Yeah. See, the back of that freebase use are the regular everyday problems that these kids go through, and Hector went through in particular. Hector had gotten busted leaving an after-hours club one night. He was really making what the kids call stupid, fresh, crazy money. He had been behind the scale, which means that when you want to make in the cocaine hustle, making good means to get behind the scale. It means that you're in command of large quantities of drugs. You have control over prices and selling techniques, and you direct the work of subordinates. He was behind the scale, was leaving one night with a couple ounces of cocaine and some girls, ran a red light, got busted by the police. I didn't realize at the time when he got out of jail, he spent almost a year, why he started freebase, and it was, of course, he caused much trepidation within the group because he was Max's brother, and nobody really wanted to say anything. But he was losing customers, he was losing respect in the street because everybody knew he was on the pipe. But the reason why he was on the pipe, again, go back to the everyday problem, was that he was raped in prison. I only found that out much later.
Oh, that's not mentioned in the book.
No, it's not mentioned in the book because I didn't know it until after I had sent in the last pieces for the book. And I decided just to keep it out because it would be too much trouble to go and put it in because it was a long, involved piece, not just to say he was raped, but why he was raped and all of that. But it really would have explained his behavior behind freebasing, because before he went in, he was very much anti-freebasing. As you know, there is a code of ethics in the cocaine business. That is, one doesn't snort cocaine, or if one does, that's only at a limited level and a limited amount. And freebasing is totally taboo.
Mm-hmm.
And but at any rate, this is really the reason why he started to freebase.
Yeah.
And Max took over from him because obviously Hector was no longer able to control the business. He was no longer disciplined, and he had lost respect in the street. He owed the Connect $20,000, and then, of course, after that, at that point, the Connect asked Max if he had the numbers and had the connections to the buyers, and he said yes, and he said, look, I think it'd be wise if you got behind the scale, and that's how Max took over.
Mm. Which is not the usual way of getting to that position of control.
No.
Most people sort of rise up through the ranks, to speak.
That's right. It's interesting that the importers, this older man, had a great affection for, and it's interesting that you talk about this as if it's a legal entity, but he had a certain amount of affection for Max and for Hector, for that matter, and saw this also as an opportunity to keep this network going.
Hmm.
Because Hector had made a great deal of money for him. I don't know how much. Had made a great deal of money for him. And I think he saw that going out the window if he didn't recruit the younger brother, who was already involved in dealing to a certain extent anyway. I mean, he was already on the street, and he was almost 15, and he knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, I'd just like to reintroduce for people who may have tuned in since the beginning of the program. Our guest is Terry Williams. He's a sociologist. He's author of the book, The Cocaine Kids. It is published by Addison Wesley Publishing Company, out recently. It is a collection of information that he gathered spending quite a bit of time over several years with a number of young cocaine dealers in New York City. If you have questions for us, please do call 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the impressions that you do get reading the book is one of the things you have to almost keep reminding yourself is this is an illegal enterprise,
mm-hmm.
because something about the way it is organized, the way that these people feel towards what they do, there were so many hallmarks of a normal business.
Yeah.
That's one of the sort of odd things about it, that you have to keep reminding yourself, you know, this is bad stuff, this is illegal, and it is also something that for them, for the people who are involved in it, is very dangerous, because they face the possibility of arrest, and people do get killed, and it's, there's this odd quality to it of normalcy that's not normal.
Yeah, I think what should be understood about this is that these kids view this drug as a commodity. Commodity to be sold, not to be used. And they use all the selling techniques and strategies and marketing strategies that the old Coke, if you remember Coca-Cola,
mm-hmm.
used to provide the new Coke. When crack was introduced, they looked at the market. They tried to decide who the best buyers were and how to save as much money as they could on the production of it. But I think, David, what's really behind all of this is that all of these teenagers aspire to make good. They have the desire to show their families, their friends, that they can succeed at something, and they can move up a career ladder, even if they've invented that career ladder, and make money. And I think part of the reason why that's the case is that they've been shut out from disappearing entry-level jobs in the mainstream economy for the most part, and they find this illegal employment, illegal employment opportunities in this highly profitable and rapidly growing multinational drug trade as the key to their success. I think these teenagers despise being poor, as most people do, and they want what other Americans want. They want the big payoff, they want the lotto, and they want those adult values like power, respect, prestige, and wealth, and they seem to want it now. And this is why this product is viewed as a commodity.
Did they seem to have any hesitancy coming out of the fact that, I mean, not only what they were doing was illegal, but that the product has certain dangers and that people do die from using it?
No, I don't think so. First of all, at the earliest stages of this, that market was predominantly a middle and upper class market. Most of the buyers that came through these kids were from New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and that sort of place, and those places. You had, of course, a large number of middle-class people in New York City proper that were buying from them. I don't think they viewed the product in that way at all. They saw it simply as a product. If you remember when Kitty, the young woman in the started Dollagram,
mm-hmm.
that was in direct response to law enforcement efforts to come down heavy on buyers. Buyers were afraid to go into the copping zones. Copping zones are areas where you go to buy, which can be a building or several buildings or one block or several blocks. And when the police started confiscating cars and harassing buyers, Kitty hooked up with Max to start the phone courier service, which was Dollagram, where the buyers would simply take a card from her, and she would call them back and deliver the drug. Of course, she made other entrees into the prostitution world and the call girl world to increase that. But all of those buyers were middle and upper class, some very famous people whose names, of course, were kept out of that book. But that is really what the heart of this thing is to sort of make good any way you can with making a rational choice theory, if you will, a rational choice. You had death, which is always a possibility. You had prison, or you could make it rich.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too besides selling the powder form of the drug, that these kids also did sell crack. Although they seemed to be really down on it and down on people who used it.
Yeah, I mean that's not uncommon because in order for you to make money, you have to disassociate yourself from your product. If you're selling chocolate, if you sit in a store and eat the chocolate all day, you wouldn't make very much money. And the same thing happens with the cocaine. If you sat around and snorted the cocaine or freebased the cocaine, which takes a tremendous amount of drugs, by the way, snorting is a very controlled, or intranasal use, is a very controlled way of using the product. But if you are freebasing, that means you're going to take volumes and volumes. You're going to eat up your product and eat up your profit very, very quickly. So that was highly frowned upon. The whole idea, of course, was to make money.
Do you have any idea how much money they did make during the years that they were operating?
Well, I think Max was pretty accurate in that he said he made his connection about $8 million, and I think that's pretty accurate. I think Chile made Max close to $1 million, and Max himself, I'm sure he made about $2 million, and because at the rate he was going, when I was at Columbia University at the time, at the Conservation of Human Resources, working with Eli Ginsberg, who's an economist, and I was finishing up the book, and he said, "Listen," he said, "you really have to find out about this, about how much money they make," which was, I was writing about it, I was recording it, but I wasn't really actually sitting there watching them count the money. And I started to do that. I would count the kilos that came in, and I would make an assessment of how much Max was charging per kilo, noticing the price structure changed drastically over those years. Because in 1980, the kilo was 50,000. By 1983, 84, it was around 25,000-30,000. But Max was making at that time about $10,000 a week by 1984, 85. And he did that for close to 3 years. That's quite a lot of money. Yeah. The other kids did not fare as well, mainly because after Chile left the scene, they were no longer able to keep the place, keep the business going. They didn't have access to the importer, which meant that they didn't have access directly to the product. They had to go through several people, which meant there was adulterator down the line. They weren't able to make quite as much money. But they still made a great deal.
In doing this, you yourself were in and around a lot of illegal activity and in places that I would guess might have been a little scary.
Yeah, it's very true. I think the closest to time that I really became frightened was when Max had started to receive these shipments of Peruvian cocaine and Bolivian cocaine, which is high quality cocaine. And he started to receive these kilo packages, and he wanted me to see them. He had then at that point had a number of what are called stash houses, which are places that you keep your drugs, keep your money, keep the money separate from the drugs, never keep the money and the drugs together in the same apartment. And he bought these dogs, these Japanese dogs called Akitas. These are dogs, of course. They wouldn't bark. But if anybody came in the place, you couldn't leave. They would kill you. And he had this stash house, and he invited me up to see the new key packages and to see how the operation was going. I hadn't seen him for about 3 weeks. And I was there sitting there with him and Hector and this Akita. And it just dawned on me that these places are really highly sought after by what are called both the get high cops. These are police officers who are involved in confiscating drugs from dealers and keep those drugs and then sell them to other dealers and or use the drug. And the stick up kids, who are kids in the street who sort of follow dealers to see where their stash houses are, and they rob them. Of course, if you're there, they kill you. And I knew all about this. And here I am, you know, sitting there listening to Jake talk about latest girl conquest, and it just dawned on me that somebody could come here and rob this place, and I'm sitting there. So at that point, I just got up and said, "Look, I'm going to go. I'll see you guys later." But there were times like that really frightened me. But most of the time, you cannot be frightened or scared because then you can't get the work done.
Well, I have a caller here we'd like to bring into the conversation. We'll do that. Somebody on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, hello.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot imagine how incredible this conversation sounds to a senior citizen. It is probably one of the most frightening exposés I've ever heard of. Now, I'd like to ask a question. It seems to me that there is no way that this society is going to extricate itself from this malaise. This war on drugs is just a charade. There's no way to stop an enterprise that has integrated this quickly into our society. This nonsense of stopping things at the border and what is apparently going on in Colombia is a brutal effort, because it sounds like the third world's answer to the superpowers. Now, would you help me out here?
Well, what's your name? What's your name?
She didn't. I don't know if she.
No, I would really. Establish my vulnerability for me.
All right. No, I think what you're asking, if I get that correctly, is what can be done. And you're also saying that the war on drugs is not really a war at all. Well, I'd like to respond to both of those. One is that what can be, in conjunction. One is that what can be done is that we have to go back and reestablish why these kids get involved and young people and others get involved in this business at the beginning. And most of them got involved because of the lack of opportunities that exist. Now, let me explain that for a second. In 1983, at the heart of the cocaine kids, when the kids were really involved en masse, you had a year before JTPA, which is these programs that were established by the government, CETA, other programs, were all cut out by the Reagan administration. Almost all the job programs were gone. Unemployment among minorities already had a 20-year job crisis. In other words, it was over 20 years that we recognized that progress has been very, very slow in getting young people jobs. And those legitimate opportunities sort of went out the window, and new opportunities emerged in the underground economy, and this was the drug business. Kilo prices dropped by half. Suddenly you saw this emergence of entrepreneurial zeal within this illegal entity. Now, if we were to do something about it, we have to sort of not compete with the drug business, but offer alternatives for young people who are willing to come out of the business. What I see in my research here, and around the country for that matter, is young people, by the time they reach 18, 19, really burned out of the drug business, where the money used to be there, it's not anymore, where the risk taking, they no longer want to risk dying anymore. They really want a second chance. But there aren't opportunities for second chances. So we have to somehow establish those opportunities. One of the opportunities that could emerge out of this is national service. We can get young people who want to leave those environments, get them involved in other national service in some form, like Herb Cables is doing with the National Park Service, getting young people out of those communities and doing work in the Park Service. There are other people who are interested in mobilizing mentorships, getting young people involved in kind of mentoring programs. So what we have to do is reestablish a hold on these communities. We have to work with the families, work with schools, and work with these kids individually in order to get them to come out of this. It is possible. It's not impossible. But, again, this war on drugs doesn't attempt to do that. It only attempts to lock people up and throw away the key.
What are you going to do about the consumer? I mean, to me, that is it isn't the enterprise. It's the consumer that patronizes the enterprise. I mean,
okay. No, it's true. It's true. Now,
I mean, what are you going to do with them? I mean,
Okay, well, the consumer is America. We live in a chemocratic society. Chemocratic meaning we live in a society where chemicals are everything for us. Both, the only difference between legal and illegal drugs is a historical accident. We have to recognize that we are chemically oriented, that we need chemicals to do just about everything that we do, and we can't stop that kind of insatiable appetite. So the consumers, that's another issue altogether. It will involve it will involve all of us saying no to drugs, if you will.
Well, it would seem to me that the person that should be prosecuted in this case is the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not the entrepreneur.
Well, the they've attempted to do that, but you see, most of the consumers are middle and upper class users.
I know, but why not put them in boot camp, shave their head, leave them there for a year?
Well, you should really write to Mr. Bennett and offer that as a solution.
Well, listen, I've taken a lot of your time. You've scared the devil out of me.
I'm really sorry.
But I think that we all need to be, the way you're presenting this is the only way that we're ever going to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Not with these war on drugs. That's like throwing money down a rat hole.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have someone else we'll get onto in just a second. Our guest this morning is Terry Williams. He is a sociologist and is author of the book The Cocaine Kids. We'll talk some more with him in a moment. This morning, we're talking with Terry Williams. He is a sociologist. He is currently a senior research scholar at the Center for Social Research at the City University of New York, where he's working on a MacArthur Foundation-supported study of successful adolescent development in public housing neighborhoods. He's the author of the book The Cocaine Kids. Between 1982 and 86, he spent a lot of time talking with and observing 8 young cocaine dealers in New York City. He wrote a book that was intended to try and answer some very basic questions about their lives, how they got into the cocaine business, how they stayed there, how long they stayed, what were the rewards for those who succeeded. And it is all recorded in this book, The Cocaine Kids, and it's published by Addison Wesley Publishing. If you have some questions, and we now have several people lined up who do, you can give us a call. The number here is 333-9455. That's our local number. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Let me just ask you quickly, Dr. Williams, before we go on to some other callers, what people, I think, will realize listening to you, and what's very obvious in the book, is that these young people gave you extraordinary access to their lives, were very frank with you, allowed you to see all aspects of their operation, and I suppose you're asked this question a lot. Why do you think that they trusted you enough to take you into their confidence this way?
Well, it involved quite a number. First of all, I'm always sponsored. I've been doing research like this for almost 15 years. A lot of that research has been, I was in prison, teaching in prison. I met a lot of people in prison. I met a lot of people in the underground economy. I've already established myself pretty much as a person who writes about street life and culture. The young man who sponsored me, who introduced me to Max, for example, I had been writing about. I became like a street biographer, and when I asked somebody, like, well, Dave, if I asked you if you have a biographer, what's your response?
I'd say no.
You said no, but if you did, you'd be flattered.
Yeah.
That somebody would be recording your every move, recording your life, and I think this is the way the kids took. Accepted me as a kind of biographer, and we know that the imagery of these young people is oftentimes negative, and here they otherwise go unnoticed, except through some degradation ceremony, being arrested, going through these halls of shame called courtrooms. These kids are only visible through that imagery. So here's a person who comes along, wants to write about them and record their lives. And I lucked out in the sense that nobody could predict that Max would become a multi-kilo dealer, would make the kind of money that he made. He's one of the top, he's in the top 10% of a pyramid type of diagram, if you will. Most of the people don't make that much money. They're way at the bottom. And I lucked out because he happened to have done that. And I was with him before the other kids came in to be members of the crew, so I was there when they came along. So that made it easier for me to link up with them because he introduced me to them, and I saw them as they came through the setup. So that's really how I got involved. But I've used this method of networking quite some time successfully in doing all of my research.
Yeah. You talk in the book about your approach, and it really is, you use the term ethnography, and I think that that's perfectly appropriate. It's as much ethnography as people who go to leave the United States and go to other places and record other cultures and societies. I guess the one of the fundamental challenges for people who do that, though, is maintaining their objectivity, their apartness, trying to remain non-judgmental, if that's possible. Was that all difficult for you?
Well, yeah, it's difficult. First of all, I'm a man first, an ethnographer second, a sociologist, if you will, third. I'm a person who's moved and appalled by the events that affect me every day. A lot of things these kids did that I did not agree with. I had conversations with them about getting out of the business. There were times when I became totally frustrated at Hector, for example, for not changing his behavior and getting off Freebase. You know, there were lots of things like that emerge, and it's hard to play scientist. You have to be a person and feel for what was going on. But I felt underlying all of it was my attempt to go beyond the stereotype. I had to know what it is about these kids that caused them to do this. And by doing that, humanize, so that whoever reads this book will get a chance to see that these are young people trying to find a way. And not to see them as some stereotype with their caps, ace, deuce, tray, standing on a corner with switchblades, selling this deadly product. And that if I was to humanize, if I could get just a tiny bit of that into this book, then I would have succeeded in doing what I think was the right thing.
Yeah. Well, I have several callers here. In fact, my lines are full, so why don't we talk with these folks who are listening. We'll go first to line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying this program very, very much. David, you already asked part of my question. I wanted to know how he managed to get close to these young people, but now I'm interested in what his relationship is with these young people now. I mean, it sounds as though you became so emotionally involved with this, and you know, you wanted to present them as human beings, that it would seem to me it would be difficult to now pull away from them, even though you're not doing more research. I mean, have you just decided to maintain a continual link with this world?
Sure. I think it's important to remember that when I said that I was a man first and ethnographer and society, what that means is that I don't forget about people because the study ends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't cut them off from talking to me or helping them if I can after this is all over. My links with people that I write about in these urban social worlds that I write about is a continual relationship, as long as they want to maintain one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that by my writing about them and using them and then writing a book and all of that, that it should end there.
Mm-hmm.
So this has never been my attempt. This is my fourth book, although Dave only mentioned two. This is my fourth book, and each time I've had relationships with people, I've maintained them as long as I could or as long as they wanted to. Max is in Florida. Kitty, I still keep contact with Kitty.
Mm-hmm.
Jake is still involved in the cocaine business, although I don't see him. Hector is in Santo Domingo. Chile was shot. If you read the book, you know that I won't tell you all of that, but he was shot doing a robbery by the stick-up kids. Master Rap is a cook. Charlie went to college. I wrote a letter of recommendation for him to get in school. And Splib is doing some work in another state.
Mm-hmm.
But because of their activities, I can't be very specific about them and or my contacts.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, who knows who's listening and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I understand.
I have to protect them because of the confidentiality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
All right. Sure. Thank you for the call. We'll go next to line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'm also enjoying the program and learning a great deal listening. I have a question about what the cocaine kids do or did with the money they earned. Does it just provide basic support for family and extended family and maybe friends, or anybody's saving the money for education, either putting someone else through or hoping to put themselves through school one day.
Well, it's very interesting that you asked that question, because the cocaine kids, many of them didn't use the money wisely. It's, you know, as you see with Hector, Hector mm-hmm. probably smoked up all of the money that he made, or gave it away, or parted it away, which is the usual way that kids do. Max did do rather well with his money, and Kitty did rather well with hers as well. It is difficult to say. Charlie never really made a great deal of money because he was so low on the totem pole, but he did go to school, ended up going to school and going to college. Jake, of course, reinvested his money into the cocaine business. But as a rule, these kids don't do well with the money because they think that, well, if I made $100 today, I can make $100 tomorrow, and they sort of spend it as quickly as they make it. But I can't say that is true of most of the community that I'm looking at, Washington Heights. I see a great deal of micro enterprises. There are a number of places that and businesses in that community that I would think are supported by this underground economy. And one thing you must realize, that the teenagers are following a tradition that dates back almost to the beginning of this country, which is to they tried an illegitimate path that to establish a stake in the mainstream. And we know the Italians, the Irish, and other communities were all involved in some manner in organized crime. But in a generation or so, they became legitimate. The kids attended Harvard and Princeton and became district attorneys and that sort of thing. And I think this is what the Dominicans and blacks and others are trying to do through this illegitimate drug economy. They're trying to get a stake in the system, and I think many of them have done that.
So when they want to get out of the business, they manage to take their experience in the business and perhaps some money and go into a more
legitimate business. Yeah.
Okay, but it's not through the traditional, I could say traditional, it's not through the route of getting an education.
Not really. It's more through entrepreneurship, starting stores, cleaners, small, what they call head shops, and building up. It's using whatever is available in the community, that's needed in the community at the time. It seems to be that's where the money goes to.
Perhaps that's not unlike other immigrant groups in this country, where college doesn't come in until two or three generations into this country.
That's right, not at all.
Okay, because education is so often touted as the answer to the drug problem, and it sounds like what you're saying is maybe that's not the answer.
No, it's only one of the answers.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, I thank you for the call. Again, we'll go on to another caller. We'll go to line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm spurred on by the first caller. I believe that the woman was a bit too punishment-oriented, and she's forgetting what your guest has just been talking about in terms of an underground economy, and that drugs are pretty much a question of time and place as to whether or not they're illegal. I wondered if you would expand on an analogy between the prohibition of alcohol during the Volstead Act, 1920 to 33, as I remember, and this current period.
Would I expound on that?
Yes, would you talk a bit about, as a sociologist, how the Irish and Italian communities, the Jewish community, was involved in moving prohibited intoxicating substances.
I make the analogy to one of the most loved families in America, which is the Kennedy family. Oh, we happen to be Irish. Whose money, whose basis of their wealth, came from the family's early involvement in illegal gun alcohol running out of Canada. That formed the basis of their fortune. And I think the whole point I was making about that is that drugs are the nexus between a kind of cultural refusal among these young people and economic opportunity. And the illegitimate economy is the only economy where many of those who are refused can employ their entrepreneurial talents. and they follow that same kind of path, meaning historically, like the Kennedy family, starting illegitimately to build a fortune and to go legitimate or toward respectability. That's the only analogy I can draw at this point. It's a little long-winded to speak more about the Volstead Act and all the rest. Okay. But I appreciate your question.
We're also growing kind of short on time. I have a couple of other people holding, and I will we'll try and get them both in. We'll go next to line number three.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I've been listening. I really like what I hear you saying. I like the way you're portraying people as normal. I have gone on to college. I've had 7.5 years of training in behavioral sciences and health. But when I started doing drugs when I was 13 or 14, and I was on the streets, and I was in a world very similar to what you're describing. And I had some advantages in that I came from a well-educated family. And when push came to shove, I was able to make some choices. And what I did personally was go to a group of people who were doing something very illegitimate still at that time in the 70s, but it was healthy. It was like I went from drugs to health foods.
Mm-hmm.
I went from hanging out the street and those nice group activities to being together with people to meditate and Eastern religion. And I was very lucky. I think the luckiest thing was that my mother was open-minded enough to see that even though she didn't approve of the kind of group living situations I was in, that they were healthier than the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening is I lived in a commune, we ran a health food store together, we taught meditation, and later I built on that, and this is a bit emotional for me. But what I really liked about what you were doing is that I was really surprised at the first caller. I can understand because she's very far away from that situation, perhaps isolated. But I thought it was pretty obvious from what you're saying and from what I've seen that it's a very normal community activity. People get together to help each other out with their families, not because it's necessarily altruistic, but because it's your own survival depends on having friends, even if they're business friends and even though the business is shady. And having an opportunity, for me knowing, for example, that eventually I did have family resources where I could go to college if I played the game right, really made a difference. And that knowing that I knew kinds of people and I knew about, I was well-read, and I could be informative about health and nutrition, that made me a valued member of a different kind of group.
Yeah.
And it was I really was interested also when you were talking about that these are cooperative activities. It's not just an individual. You think in terms of the group. And I think that's really the way to go about making a change in the drug world, if we want to.
Mm-hmm.
Is, for example, what they're saying in Colombia, that the coffee growers are having lower prices. If we were really against drugs and cocaine growing in Colombia, if it was a legitimate fight against drugs and rather than a political scheme, then we would be supporting coffee growers and helping them go back to coffee growing if we wanted to support that kind of drug. And I think that's the same thing with groups of people on the streets making money off of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at it as a normal activity. It's a business. Let's look at it economically, and let's look at it normally. And if we're going to send users, for example, there was an idea of sending users to jail. Well, let's use social scientists' understanding. Let's say, how likely are you to use drugs before and after coming in an institution? You are more likely to be a drug user when you come out of a very demeaning situation like that.
Yeah.
And so that's not a solution. And I think looking at people as normal human beings who have their own problems, we all have problems, that's a specific kind they have, we can come up with solutions. And I think the kind of work you're doing is the most beneficial. Someone who's behind the scenes and says, was that person better off before and after going into that courtroom, for example?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks for letting me give my piece, though.
That's quite all right.
Okay.
Thank you. Enjoy.
Thank
all right.
You. Let's. Did you want to comment on anything that the caller had to say?
No, I thought it was very well put.
Okay. Let me just try and get one more person in here before we have to finish. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Yes. Since these are just kids, could you talk a little bit about how they managed the police?
How they managed the police?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there were lots of approaches that we used toward the police. Max changes his phone number every 3 months, for example. I'd mentioned about the stash houses where he would keep drugs and money in different places. He would also change those stash houses. They had concepts called piggybacking concept in the copping zone. Piggybacking meant that they would have a cocaine house office at what they call La Oficina, in the basement, which was a scale and cocaine, and you could come in and buy. They'd have another place on the first or second floor, another one on the third or fourth floor. So when the police busted the basement, for example, they would have the first floor still operating. They busted the first floor, they would have the second floor. So they had that kind of a system going. I talked about the Get High Cops. The Get High Cops were the cops who would come in dressed as undercover, flash their badge, stand in line to buy the coke, flash their badge, take the cocaine off the table, take the money out of the shopping bag and leave. They would do this several times a week, often leaving with $2,000 and $3,000. In order to stop that from happening, Max would put less cocaine out on the table. He would have stash catchers. The stash meaning stash is another word for drugs. Stash catchers would be young men at the bottom of the back of the apartment who would when they heard about a bus, they would wrap the cocaine up, throw it and the money, and throw it to the stash catcher in the back. We know about how Kitty used Dollagram. She operated out of a limousine for the most part. She would, at that time, they had the starting with the smoke windows. They used high tech, of course, used beepers at that time too, so phone couldn't be tapped. The limousine had smoke windows, and police rarely involved limousine because they assumed you were upper class if you were in the limousine. These were some of the methods that they used.
We're going to have to stop just because we've come to the end of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we could continue. I can only recommend to people if they're interested in reading more. There is much more to be read in the book. It is entitled The Cocaine Kids. Terry Williams, the author, published by Addison Wesley Publishing. Dr. Williams, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.